But it's not their categorisation as a capital payment that determines whether or not it's a royalty. It's whether it falls within one of the items listed in Section 6 of the 1936 Act that defines a royalty.
You're listening to Australia's podcast for accountants, Tax Talks, the podcast to grow your firm.
Welcome to episode 319 of Tax Talks. This is Heide Robson, and thank you to Class for sponsoring this episode. Cross-border royalties. What do you need to look out for when your clients pay royalties to an overseas entity? This is the question Clint Harding and Alexander Rasmussen of Arnold Bloch Liebler in Sydney will discuss with you in this episode. The first question to Alexander Rasmussen is, what is the difference between franchise fees and royalties?
Royalty incomes, if we go back to the legislation to start with, it's always a good place to begin. The usual things you'll see are things like use of copyright, patents, trademarks, even rights to use equipment or supply of some kind of industry knowledge are generally considered to be royalties. And that can also extend to sort of a supply of any kind of assistance related to rights to use copyrights, for instance.
That means franchise fees are basically royalty fees, correct?
Well, not necessarily. So the ATO has a view, and I think it's currently, or it has recently released some guidance that sort of looks at this notion of royalty payments or copyrights, and to the extent that this interplays with franchise fees can be pretty relevant. But franchise fees in the view of the ATO are often sort of a form of capital payment. So it's an upfront capital cost, i.e. isn't really recurring. So if you say you're paying a copyright for a copyright fee for every use of a piece of industry knowledge or what have you, unlikely that'd be considered a franchise fee. From the ATO's perspective, the franchise fee will typically go towards, say, the capital base of an investment you're making. So say, what's an easy example? Say you're putting up or setting up a new McDonald's, right? And under that contract, that franchise agreement you have with the franchisor, you need to pay
100,000. And that's probably a very cheap one.
Yeah, I would imagine it is. I think we just have to look at go in depth into the recent Masali case and we can see how expensive it is to run a McDonald's, especially on the Central Coast. But that will typically be a capital cost and a franchise fee in the eyes of the ATO, especially where there's no requirement to pay that fee again if you renew the contract.
So that means the first 100,000 you pay to McDonald's for the privilege of being able to open that McDonald's store, that first 100,000 is a capital payment and hence not deductible.
Yeah, typically.
Sorry, I'll just jump in. You've got to be a little bit careful. Just because something is capital or revenue in the hands of the payor doesn't really impact necessarily on whether or not it's a royalty. You've got to look first to the definition of a royalty in Section 6 of the 1936 Act, the definitions part, and then overlay the treaty, which has its own definition of royalties. And I've been involved in examples where the treaty definition of a royalty is different to the domestic version of the definition of a royalty, and therefore you've got different categories, and you've got to look at the International Tax Agreements Act and what happens in the case of an inconsistency. But it's really a factual question. As Alex said, generally a one-off payment doesn't have the character of a royalty, but if what you're doing is front-ending what would otherwise be 5 years of royalty payments, then simply paying it all as a lump sum up front isn't going to change the inherent nature of that. So it really looks, and a lot of franchise payments in my experience have other elements to it. It could involve a payment for services, could involve a payment for product if they're supplying you certain products under that sort of agreement or rights agreement that you have with them. So there may well be an apportionment exercise where only part of what you're paying as a franchise fee is attributable to any of those things that generally would be regarded as a royalty, like the use of trademarks and logos and things like that.
So with the $100,000, you basically have to look at it in two steps. The first step is it a capital payment under Australian tax law? Hence, can the franchisee or franchisor, I always confuse those two, but can the Australian business tax deduct the $100,000 payment? Or is it a capital payment? That's the first step. And then the second step is, does it qualify as a capital payment under the withholding tax rules and hence it can leave Australia without withholding tax? or does it fall under the withholding tax rules as a royalty fee that is subject to withholding, correct?
Yeah, there's a bit to unpack there, but I think that would generally be the case. I mean, we have to look at what the character of the payment is in both hands, right? Clint is right that, you know, to the extent that you can get to a position where you're comfortable, it's royalty. Yeah, you have to go back to your touchstone, which is the domestic legislation, the definition there, generally speaking. The definitions in the DTAs, I think, are in more cases than not relatively consistent with the domestic definition that we have here. But as Clint noted, you know, there are, I'm sure, a lot of instances where they're not. And then, as again, he mentioned, you have to go look at the international tax agreement and look at how you're going to work through any inconsistency there. So it's really important in the first place, I think, to find out and define what you're working with.
So not all franchise fees are royalties, because franchise fees might also be capital payments, both under our Australian CGT rules and also under the withholding tax rules.
That's right, but it's not their categorisation as a capital payment that determines whether or not it's a royalty. It's whether it falls within one of the items listed in Division 6, Section 6 of the 1936 Act that defines a royalty.
And those Alex already mentioned, so like equipment, copyright, processes, training, those items.
Correct.
Because the payment, of course, could also be for something else, like interest or something else.
Yeah, supply services, a right to do something, which isn't necessarily the right to use. Generally, a royalty is a right to use something. So that dictates that it's something that already exists and is protected and has value. And what you're doing is allowing someone else to use it and you're deriving income for that. The grant of commercial right. Like a good example of some of the nuance in this area is the ATO has just... it's either draft or it's been finalised on software licences. There's a lot of work at the OECD level, and the ATO again just investigated it as to what extent, if you pay a software licence, or is that a royalty? And a lot of there's a lot of detail in there as to what is that software licence. If it's purely just a right to distribute the software in Australia, so it's like rights to distribute where you can't actually go into the software and alter the source code or anything like that. I'm going to get rapidly out of my depth because my computing knowledge sort of stops at my PlayStation. But if you can alter the source code, then that generally involves you having some sort of right to actually use the magic source in that piece of software, being the industry knowledge or copyrighted information, whereas a mere right to distribute shrink-wrapped software isn't a royalty.
Quick question. I have seen agreements between Australian and overseas businesses where a fee was agreed that is a percentage of profit, but is for the privilege of buying stock at cost. And then, of course, the question is that a royalty or not? So it wasn't called a royalty. It was just said for the privilege of buying stock at cost, you pay us, I think it was 25% per year of your profit.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's a good question. Again, you've got to go back. I mean, if that landed on my desk and I was advising a client, you'd have to go straight to 661. You'd have to pick up the contract and actually understand. But I mean, that seems to me sort of just a premium on allowing them to buy stock, which, I mean, purchasing stock isn't a royalty. That's not the right to use trademarks or copyright or anything like that. So generally, I don't think purchasing stock off someone's going to be a royalty. And therefore, if you receive some sort of fee and that's the sort of underlying driver to that fee, it should adopt the same character. So, I mean, instinctively, I would say it probably isn't a royalty.
I see. But then isn't that then an easy way out? Then you just define all payments between investor and Australian business as a payment for the purchase of stock at cost.
If that's what it is. But if, as a matter of fact, you're also getting other things as part of that agreement, like the right to use industrial know-how and trademarks and logos and advertising, then as a matter of fact, it's for more than that. And the ATO will, in the law, the legislation will look to you to apportion that where necessary.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, for example, the trademark, the Australian trademarks, is held by the overseas investor. And hence that payment for the privilege of buying stock at cost, of course, would then also be for the privilege of using the trademarks.
Yep. And that's where there's a lot of disputes and people do try and badge and use nomenclature that suggests something is not a royalty. But if it always goes back to evidence, and the onus is always on the taxpayer to prove that that's the case, and as a matter of substance and the evidence shows that they're actually receiving other things in exchange for the payment of that fee, not just the supply of goods, then you need to have a careful look at that.
So that means if you don't want to have an argument with the ATO, you are safer to just withhold the 5%. Often I think the withholding tax on royalties is 5%. So then you're safer to just withhold the 5%. Of course, if you're not afraid of picking a fight with the ATO, then you can dissect it and reduce it.
If you're in Australia, you've got it, you would pay it. I mean, but the point is your supplier offshore that you're paying it to may not be expecting you to withhold. And so you've got to look again to the contract and see what it says. It will generally be language in there that says you must make payments under this contract free and clear of any withholding unless required by Australian law. And then there'll be what we call a gross-up clause, where the payer in Australia is required to then gross up the payment so that the non-resident receives what they would have got without payment of withholding tax, or there won't be. So it's a commercial agreement as to who bears the burden of that withholding tax. Don't forget, withholding tax is technically a tax on the income of the non-resident, on Australian-sourced income. It's just that the burden of collecting it and paying it is put on the Australian payor.
So it all comes down to what the contract says. If the contract says the Australian business has to pay it if there is withholding, then of course the Australian business has a strong incentive to dissect it and to only apply withholding on the part that covers actual royalties.
Yep.
But if the contract is silent on it and hence the withholding would go to the detriment of the foreign investors, then the Australian business might as well do the withholding because it means they won't have to fight with the ATO later on.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's another discussion around what are the consequences of failing to withhold, and generally they are twofold. With interest and royalties, your deduction for that payment is denied. And then under section, testing my knowledge now, 16-35 of Schedule 1 to the Tax Administration Act, I think it is an administrative penalty for failing to withhold equal to the amount that you should have withheld. So the consequences for failing to withhold are severe, and the ATO will look to, in the first instance, take that up with the Australian entity that should have withheld.
Okay, so two penalties. If you don't withhold when you should have, one is you don't get a tax deduction just for the amount of the withholding or of the entire...
For the payment.
Payment, the entire payment. So 100% of the net payment plus the withholding.
Yeah.
Okay, and then also you receive a penalty.
Yes, equal to what you should have withheld. And then that's the way the ATO... Six. I mean, it's obviously easier for them to try and enforce that against an Australian entity than, as I said, try and chase a non-resident.
Yes. Yeah, of course. The buck will always stop with the Australian entity.
Yeah.
Can I quickly ask you something about double tax agreements?
Sure.
There's a very helpful overview on the Treasury website where you basically have all countries that we have DTAs with, and then you just pick the country. And some countries have lots and lots of amendments and others don't have any amendments at all.
Yeah.
Does it mean the ones where we don't have any amendments, we kind of just did it once and then forgot about it, and we don't have very active trade relationships with those countries?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, I think Treasury, there's a program in Treasury. There is a tax treaties unit, or there was, and I know a few of the people that have been in that. So there is an active program within Treasury for either signing up new treaties or modernizing some of the older ones, I suspect, but I don't know how they prioritize those, but I imagine some of it will be, as you say, be determined by how important that nation is as a trading partner. I mean, I would advise everyone to just buy a copy of, I think CCH or Thompson's does the tax treaties volume, and they provide a markup that includes all the stuff that's done in an amending protocol, so you don't have to, and now you've got the MLI as well, so you've potentially got three different things you have to look at. So we've got this multilateral instrument that was brought in post-BEPS that can apply to certain treaties, but not all of them. And then you've, as you say, you've got some treaties that have an original and then an amending protocol. So you want to try and find a version of that that has it all sort of marked up and is current.
The amending protocol with the US, in the first chapter, it covers Russia. Is that common that an amending protocol covers several countries?
Does it? I don't take that on notice, Heidi. I haven't noticed that.
So really? Chapter 1 covers Russia and chapter 2 covers the US.
No.
Yes. Quickly Google it.
Okay. I'm Googling it.
I'm on it.
Amendment Protocol 2001, number 1.
That's a great trivia question, Alex. That's going to be in our next
we'll
text
put
trivia.
That in. I've already written it down.
That is. Okay. Amending Protocol 27 September 2001.
And then have a look at chapter 1. It's about Russia.
Chapter one.
I'm afraid to Google and upset my mics again. That's why I'm not Googling.
I can't. I'm looking at the amending protocol. I can't. Let me control Russia. Yeah, you're looking at the acts. So that there's two things on the Treasury website. One is the amending protocol. The other is the piece of legislation that introduced it. And so if you go into the bill that is the link there, it's actually introducing two treaties. One is Russia, one is the US. So they're two different things.
Okay. So that means when I refer to a section, I actually shouldn't refer to that.
No, you should look at the actual protocol, and it talks about articles. The nomenclature used in tax treaties is articles. You have Article 1 through 26 or whatever. But yeah, so obviously the act that introduced the amendments in that US protocol also at the same time introduced the new Russian double tax agreement. So that's why you've got the amending act that's linked there talking about both. But if you click on the link to the actual amending protocol, it only deals with the US.
Okay, good. Thank you for that.
There goes my trivia question. That would have been a good one.
Just very quickly, when you make payments to overseas, be it dividends, be it interest or royalties, and you have to do withholding, the person, the foreign entity doesn't need an ABN or a TFN when you do the withholding, correct?
Correct. That's my understanding. There is a separate set of PA, ABN, and TFN withholding provisions in the Admin Act, but they're aimed at a slightly different thing. That's like why you have to provide your TFN or your ABN to your bank or your financial institution or your whatever platform you hold your shares through, because there's certain obligations that if you pay amounts to Australian residents and they haven't provided an ABN or a TFN, that you have to withhold on those. That's a separate type of withholding. But I think in terms of interest, royalties, and dividends, none of the obligations in the domestic law that impose those turn on TFNs or ABNs.
Do you withhold and pay withholding tax on a cash or an accrual basis? So let's say, for example, the royalties are for the 2021 financial year, but you pay the net royalties in July or August. Do you then report and pay the withholding tax in your June BES, or do you pay it in your September BES?
I'm not sure about, I mean, the actual administration and reporting for what they call withholders is different depending on whether you're a small, medium, or large withholder in terms of the frequency on which you have to lodge withholding. I think there's some sort of withholding compliance document that you lodge with the tax office, but the actual obligation under the legislation to pay withholding tax arises on payment. So mere accrual generally won't be enough. It'll arise when you actually pay it. But you've got to understand that the definition of paid has a specific meaning. So crediting to the account of and things like that can actually form or dealing with something on behalf of someone. So let's say you never actually paid the amount to the non-resident, but you offset that against the corresponding obligation. That would be payment, even though no cash actually leaves the country. If you have interest that capitalizes, so there's no actual cash payment of the interest, but it's added to the principal outstanding and then interest continues to accrue, that's payment for these purposes. So it does drive off payment of those amounts, but there are things like constructive payment that you need to be aware of that may trigger that obligation. And it also is triggered by non-cash amounts. So if you pay someone in gold bullion, pay their interest in gold bullion, you'll have to work out some way of withholding from that. Chip off a little bit with a pickaxe and send that to the commissioner.
Or cryptocurrency.
Yeah, or cryptocurrency, or more real life examples of things like payment in kind arrangements where you may issue further shares and payment of interest or things like that. So you can get some sort of reasonably unique instruments, but withholding, as I say, is cash and non-cash consideration and drives off payment or deemed payment.
So that means if it's just a straightforward case where we pay the royalties a month or 2 months after year end and there is no other obligation that we can offset with, etc., then the withholding obligation and the reporting is at payment. Even if we have recognized a liability as of 30th of June, we still only incur the withholding tax liability when we actually pay. But of course, if we offset something or pay in kind or something, then of course, then the withholding tax will be due when we actually do this offset.
Yeah, I think that's right. Oh, can I raise one more thing for your listeners?
Yes.
So where you have commercial, as we talked about, this thing called a gross-up clause. So you need to look at the contractual arrangements and effectively see who bears the commercial burden of paying that withholding tax. If there is a requirement on the Australian payor to gross up the payment to the non-resident, there's a question as to whether or not the amount of that gross-up is itself a royalty or interest on which you have to withhold. So I'll leave that as a bit of a curly one. People can figure that out. And the answer is different for interest than it is to royalties. So that additional payment that you can be obligated under the contract to pay to the non-resident can itself be interest or royalty.
Yes.
And there's this famous case, well, famous in my world, called Century Yuasa Batteries that dealt with that on royalties. And I tell you the answer, but I cannot remember it off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure the answer is that if you pay a gross up on a royalty, that's itself a royalty payment, and therefore you have to deduct royalty withholding tax from the amount of the gross up, but with interest it's not.
Very quickly, there are basically three types of payments that trigger withholding tax: dividends, interest, and royalties. Nothing else triggers withholding. And actually, that is not true because you also have capital gains, for example. It's just that it's always said in this one sentence: interest, dividends, and royalties. It's always, you know, it's always these three. But there are actually a lot more, aren't there?
Yeah, there are. And there's other categories for things like casino junket arrangements. There's a whole list of categories that attract non-resident withholding tax for certain strange things like casino junket arrangements and a bunch of other things. I think construction payments are in there as well. So there are entertainment and sports people have their own sort of withholding rules as well. Payments to entertainers and sports people. So there are different types of withholding. It's not just interest with interest dividends and royalties, although those are obviously the three that get the most attention.
Welcome back. So royalties are for the right to use an asset, to use property, and it is often intellectual property like copyright, patent, trademark, expertise, processes, mining rights, etc. So royalties are for the right to use something. A franchise fee, on the other hand, can be a royalty payment, but it doesn't have to be. For a franchise fee, you have to ask what the fee actually covers. Is it for the right to use something, or is it for interest, or is it a capital payment? What is it? And then based on the answer, you treat that payment accordingly. So for example, if it is a capital payment, then you don't need to worry about withholding tax. If it is a royalty, you withhold 5%, and if it is interest, you withhold 10%. But always check the relevant DTA. Tomorrow we have another US episode, US number 9, where Seth Hertz of US Expect Tax will discuss with you when and how Australian companies go into a US individual tax return, a 1040. Is it just dividends paid, or is there a look-through approach? And in our regular episode next Monday, episode 320, Clint Harding of Arnold Block Liebler in Sydney will talk about inbound investments. What happens to your Australian tax position when you receive an inbound investment from overseas, be it debt or equity? That is the question for next Monday. And then, to just give you a general feel for what is to come, we have 5 more episodes about international tax, some of them with a US tax aspect. That is probably the longest mini-series we've ever done. In total, we will have done 11 episodes and updates about international tax. That is quite a lot. After that, let's touch on a few other topics, but then dive into property development. I have a feeling that we will run out of covering or even starting cryptocurrency this year, but I really want to get you good insights into property development before we break up for the year. So that's the plan for the weeks ahead. Until either tomorrow or next Monday, thank you for listening, and thank you to Class for their support. Bye for now, and see you in the next episode.